Okay. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our regular Monday stream. We are not late.
However, the thumbnail isn't on the screen.
Oh no. It's sorry, I was testing it. But yes, the thumbnail should be on the screen, and now it is. But yes, hello everyone, and welcome to our
The not late stream.
yes, the not late stream. We are not late. I don't know why we're waffling about this.
We are not late and never have been and
No.
never will be.
No,
Except from those times that we were, but that wasn't our fault.
that was
Yeah,
not.
see, Harry G Man's corrected himself in the chat. Late, not late.
Yeah, we always try and start before 1 minute passed. Although there is a weird quirk with the way that YouTube serves people things, in that you get the most attention while it's waiting to go live. I don't know. Maybe that's the key to like AA's entire career.
Yeah, no, basically.
In that he has people just left on going live, but that's kind of neither here nor there. Before we start, is there anything we need to talk about really? I guess for the benefit, I'll talk about it during this, near the end of the stream as well. But for the benefit of people who are asking, Nomos tickets will probably go up March 1st, I would say, if not March 2nd. The plan was always to put them up at the beginning of March.
Yes.
To be overly honest, that it's better timing it at the beginning or the end of a month, because that's when people get paid.
Well, no, but we've also had a fair few folk asking, and lots of people are already keen for it, so that's always good to hear.
Yeah, there are people being rather keen, but it's.
I suppose we'll do the usual sort of shilling as well, of once again thanking all the people who turn up to the streams regularly,
Yes,
whether they watch them live or watch them later in the VOD. Hello, people in the future.
Hello, future people. How are
Yeah.
you doing?
Do you live on the dirt farms yet, future
Yeah, do you
people?
live on the dirt farms? But yes, welcome. I already see a couple of our members in the chat. Aurelian Nautilus Caesar there and S. Smith.
New from the academic agency. Foundations of Timekeeping.
Yes, exactly. It's definitely something that
Fantastic.
might be needed. But as you can see by the fact that we have members and Anthony Keane there straight away. We are still monetized. Somehow, if you guys want to support us on a recurring basis, memberships are currently the best way. But if you guys want questions to be answered, obviously you can send a super chat. But the best way is just like we've patched Streamlabs for now. I promise I set up an entropy. I didn't have time. I'm sorry. I also got slightly confused trying to do it. I know real boomer hours, but we will have like a stream element or an entropy. We'll have something else set up so.
I have noticed that. I'm not sure if people are doing it deliberately, but a few people just putting in like one time, 1 month subscriptions for the Substack, which I suppose works as well, but
Yeah,
the
that works.
Stripe tends to take 2/3 of that offers, so.
Oh yeah, that does also happen. But yeah, if you guys want to see our written content as well, whilst everyone's filtering in, there is also the anti-politics Substack that we've managed to keep quite up to date. I'm quite happy with that. And we have something going out tomorrow, don't we?
Yes, I should do. I'll probably give it a quick reread tomorrow morning just to make sure, and I don't know if you want to add anything else to it.
I'll have a quick look at it again, but we should definitely have our at least weekly content on the Substack, so you're seeing a lot of us. You're seeing a lot of us in written and in stream form.
You better not get sick of us.
But that's enough. We've done our obligatory 5 minutes of
Yes,
waffle.
algorithm rituals do go and summon the
Yeah.
Susan Wojcicki's or whoever
Yeah. So.
the sorry, her non-union Indian equivalent.
Yes, a non-union Indian government has taken over. We praise Pujeet, and we pray for a bountiful curry leaf harvest. You can't see us, but we're doing
Yeah,
the
I'm putting the light bulbs in.
What we're talking about today is something some of you may have heard of in passing, and if you've read a lot of the WEF style, kind of a. As we're going to The Economist and people like that have been mentioning degrowth, but degrowth has become a buzzword, especially this year. I've noticed a lot of it has been front-loaded into this year. Is the year of degrowth? Is late 2022, kind of early 2023? It's breaking cover.
Year of the Shrink.
Yeah, year of the shrink. Yes, it's definitely year of the shrink. But to to get on with it.
Get on with it.
We're going to start at one of the better summaries and actually a decent link stem, which is the World Economic Forum, of course.
Our good friends.
Yes, from June last year, June 2022. Degrowth. What's behind the economic theory and why does it matter right now? I mean, of course, it goes without saying that degrowth is linked to suffering for our carbon gods. This is, environmentalism writ large, very large, as you'll see. But the degrowth thing is very much the watchword right now, along with things like global governance. Also, this, an aside, the World Economic Forum website is so horrendous in terms of its optimization that it looks cartoonishly bad on desktop because it is so overly optimized for mobile. You'll see big, massive, wide banners, teeny, skinny text underneath it. That means they're going to have to zoom in again. Degrowth is a radical economic theory born in the 1970s. It broadly means shrinking rather than growing economies to use less of the world's dwindling resources. It is what it sounds like. There's going to be a lot of weird mental and economic gymnastics here, but most of it is like window dressing, as we'll come to see. It deliberately doesn't make any sense. Or where it does make sense, it's deliberately terrible. But as we always say, the suffering is the point, and nowhere is the suffering the point more in terms of green policy than things like degrowth.
Mm.
Detractors of degrowth say economic growth has given the world everything from cancer treatments to indoor plumbing. We'll begin to see it as we go on the false dichotomy here between the liberal line go up march of history narrative and essentially like Pol Pot rice fields.
Yes.
The debate ranges from like boomer truth regime writ large, that's the starting point, to like actual global communism. Supporters argue that degrowth doesn't mean living in caves with candles, but just living more simply.
How simply, though?
What if we were all rice farmers?
See, I know as well already there's going to be a subset of people when this discussion becomes more mainstream. Be like, well, don't you guys read Ted Kaczynski? Wouldn't you want them to do this? It's like, well, whilst we don't want to see ourselves be like ardent supporters of material progressivism, we also don't want to have, consumption standards globally mandated by some kind of central bureau that is doing it for reasons of global equity and climate justice.
Yeah, it's like a lot of the people who talk about, well, isn't the 15 minutes walkable city a good thing? It's like, not when it's the carrot to a you will no longer be mobile stick.
Yes.
John Morton, thank you for the £5, saying good evening. Let the black pills drop like Harrika from the black rabbit of life. Oh, terrible. Terrible. But yeah. This is the key premise of degrowth, a political and economic theory that is gaining traction as fears grow over climate change. But is it workable?
Oh. I'm glad they've got a CNBC link there for us to find out. Yeah.
But this is, as I put in the notes, kind of like a fag packet version of degrowth.
Mm.
This is, how you'd explain degrowth to your nan.
Yeah, political degrowth actions might include buying less stuff, growing your own food, and using empty houses instead of building new ones. But if you put migrants in all the empty houses, there's not going to be any empty houses left.
Well, the quote-unquote bottom-up version of degrowth, which is what this tries to sell, is the idea that this will just be something that people do spontaneously themselves.
Yeah.
But as we go through a lot of the policy and politics, it becomes very clear that this is not something that people
do. Freeman as the nudging at people in the Behavioural Insights team of the podcast they do, where they're saying, oh, well, it's about making net zero the easy option by changing the choice environment so that the flow of choices goes from one direction to the other, and you're helping people go against the stream of decision making or whatever sort of nonsense they come up with to factor individual agency out of the equation.
Well, they talk about how degrowth as a term was coined in 1972 by Austrian-French philosopher André Gorz. We'll get into him in a little bit. According to the website degrowth.info. As the movement, degrowth started to take off in the early 2000s, according to media platform Open Democracy. Again, we'll get to them. That this is a good stem for links. Modern degrowth protagonists include French economist Sergei Latouche, who argues...
society's current model of economic growth is unsustainable. So would I, but probably for very different reasons.
Buzz. Global North, Global South. Here we get into, like, the weird, like, Southern Hemisphere revenge fantasy that is the original version of, kind of, the 70s degrowth.
Yes.
A lot of the stuff outside of weird, wacky French New Left philosophers that we'll get onto in a second, it was done by the quote-unquote Global South.
And it's all, like, third worldist. I mean, I think maybe
Stinky Mexican communists, yeah, basically.
I mean, the best example of this, I think, might be the Nat Geographic article that we looked at on climate reparations, where...
Yeah, I couldn't find that.
Well, they haven't gone and got rid of it, have they?
I don't think so. That's in one of the streams.
Yes.
But I didn't want to pop this in here.
No, I think it's worth mentioning that in that they say, oh, well, the models they use to decide whether or not Western pollution has caused extreme weather events in Pakistan,
yeah,
is a bit cagey. But due to historical prejudices and injustices, we must accept their data at face value. And that's, you know, that whole kind of thinking is underwritten by this kind of theory here we're seeing before us.
Yes. A lot, like I said, a lot of the degrowth stuff was like, right, we'll make your country worse to make our country better. Because, you know, it's the whole geopolitics is zero-sum game thing. Thank you for the donation there. Namuzed saying 10 Canadian dollars. So about £3. No, I'm not quite sure what the Canadian dollar's worth right now, actually. Subjects like this and the 15-minute city have only helped me wake up my normie friends. He reads between the lines more when it comes to isn't this a good thing policies. That's good. Like I said, it can be about finding a vector for people, and these, it's so obvious with some of this stuff, but like noticing, unfortunately, is only the first step. Noticing alone doesn't really do anything, but we're trying to kind of equip people with the terminology here so they can engage with the material.
Yes.
I realize we're selling ourselves a bit down the river there by saying that noticing doesn't matter, since this is a one big notice, I guess. But we'll get into some of the why knowing this is important later on, as we try to do. We try not to be like, things are bad, feel bad.
Don't worry, this stream will not just be us going, this is communism for another hour. Yeah. There is some interesting stuff to this.
There is, yes.
So we'll get on to what's his face, this André Gorz character.
Yes, the...
Or unless there's more in here you want to cover.
No, I'm just... The WF kind of goes into, like, oh, I said...
Let's go up here. Let's go for some of their historiography, if you...
Where?
Just to scroll up. We've got their thing there. Yeah. Economic growth in society dates back to the 17th and 18th century.
What? Ooh?
What about like when we went from being hunter-gatherers to agricultural? Was that not economic growth? Did we just change our minds and all
that? A World Economic Forum going full Adam Smith invented capitalism.
No one traded. 1775.
No one traded anything before Adam Smith. Yeah.
Explains our world in data. That's when technological innovation started driving increased prosperity.
Ooh. Again, the starting point of this is like extreme march.
The steam
of
engine was the first technology.
Yeah.
You know, all those sticks they tied sharp rocks onto before didn't help.
Well, it's the whole point of things, you know, like the seed, you know, screw and you know, ploughing.
Or water wheels.
Water, yeah, the water wheel.
Or, I don't know, bronze, steel. Government policies have focused on growing and expanding economies ever since. With increasing awareness about climate change, the degrowth debate has accelerated. See, that line's not even true.
No.
Because a large portion of people in Britain in like the early, late 1700s, late 1800s, when they had the whole corn laws thing, were putting across Malthusian arguments about, no, you can't keep doing this. With increasing awareness about climate change, the degrowth debate has accelerated. If economic growth continues to be the default goal, it will lead to climate catastrophe, the argument goes, with no hope of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees. Do they just throw the degrees out now?
It's very much... Well, what I'm going to get through here is that the starting point of degrowth is like the end of the rope for classic neoliberalism. Yeah. You know, we're seeing that... Well, we'll talk about that Nudge Unit podcast in our net zero stream that we eventually did.
I can't avoid the next line, yeah, though. It seems to be no coincidence that global warming caused by humans started around the 1830s. Scientists believe when the world's first industrial revolution was at its height. All those, you know, burning pits, fires, biomass heaters in people's homes. Mm. You know, the fact that the Romans grew olives here, that must have been because they had big diesel Range Rovers and stuff like that. Anyway, sorry, we'll carry on.
No, the point I'm trying to impress on people, though, is that the degrowth only makes sense if you completely steep yourself in the myths of GDP itself.
Yes, because it's of that massive abstraction kind of view.
Yeah.
It is an aggregation of almost everything into, you know, there's the whole, and this will come back into the sort of new left kind of thing, which is part of the aspect of this. You had Foucault, who believed quite strongly that the start of the French Revolution, or at least to him, was on some sort of aristocratic idea of public health and looking at the whole people below the highest rung as like a sort of livestock. And then you've got like the kind of eugenics views that spring forth from that. And
this is
the ultimate end of it. You're looking at like humans on the planet as some sort of just small pastoral system which must just be managed.
Sorry, I didn't even notice this. I didn't.
That was the first thing I looked at.
Well, the early life checks out. It's not the early life we were looking at here. It's to do with the 1960s to 80s.
Well, he's also like an existentialist at new John Paul Sartre in like 1945, 46 as well.
Yes, he is. But Gauss was also a main theorist in the French New Left movement, inspired by young Marx. Is that a young Sheldon?
The TV show they had at the time.
Yeah, discussions of humanism and alienation and the liberation of humanity. Gauss was also influenced by the Frankfurt School, since he was a friend of Herbert Marcuse. We need to get those streams done on those people.
Other friends of his included Rosanda Rosanda, founder of Il Manifesto newspaper, which is like a massive Central European, like Marxist international. Photographer William Klein, younger intellectuals, and Mark Kravitz. Again, more and more and more sort of Marxist characters. He goes on to work with all these different institutes, and he's involved in this, that, and the next, like, ecological Marxist buzzword study. And then you get to the end, which is his death, where him and his wife decided just to kill themselves in 2007.
Yeah, basically.
As you do.
But this is to show you the idea of degrowth is directly from a French Marxist who was a personal friend of the most influential member of the Frankfurt School.
Zero in chat, as you're telling me that I'll be able to check the early life section. Zero. When you're ready,
you won't need to. He's beginning to believe. Here we go. This is the degrowth.info website. Mm. More than 1,000 experts call for degrowth post-COVID-19. More than 1,000 experts call for a degrowth as post-COVID-19. That's a terribly clumsy sentence, sorry.
Yes, but this is also only just from, like, May 2020. It's only, like, 2 months after public COVID-19 started.
This is, like, 2 weeks to flatten the curve territory here in the UK.
Yeah, I would... There's some interesting... Maybe we could go to some of the names here that have got involved in this.
Who do you want to talk about here?
We'll go for the first section, then we'll go down to the five points later. In the turmoil of this crisis, our everyday lives are being shaken up. We need to reinvent, adapt, organise ourselves. This is also true for the degrowth movement. The crisis has driven us to connect, debate and set up projects. It's a lot of work to do in 2 months.
Yeah.
Today, an open letter has emerged from this brainstorm of ideas. You can't use that word anymore. It's hopefully the beginning of many more collaborative projects. the degrowth open letter signed by more than 1,100 experts and over 70 organisations from more than 60 countries calls for degrowth as a way to tackle the crisis induced by COVID-19 in order to build a more just and sustainable society and prevent further crises. It's the perfect combination of like environmentalist thinking compounded on top of environmentalist thinking.
Yes, it is.
Of course, if you think like the conditions of capitalism create climate change and poverty, then of course a disease that could somehow be linked to people living in squalor and a certain climate is of course then the cause of capitalist conditions that create. So there's just this never-ending link of stuff here, but they've got these names: Alberto Acosta, some Ecuadorian communist; Jason Hickel, some researcher from the UK; and George Moinbot, or whatever is his name on there.
Yeah.
And then you've got letters have also been respectively published in Open Democracy, Mediapart, The Wire in India, Hungary TV, somewhere in Argentina, Turkey, Spain. The letter urges national and international institutions, as well as civil society and economic actors, to follow five principles in their effort to counter the current societal and economic crisis. Taking into account social and environmental ills, it calls for degrowth, a democratically planned, yet adaptive, sustainable and equitable downscaling of the economy, leading to a future where we can live better with less. Again, the same notion as in the behavioural insights team stuff.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, net zero is going to be bad, but when we tell people that net zero is going to be bad for everyone, they're somewhat more like acceptable.
It is. It's to do with the suffering together. If everyone is put in the rice fields, they will feel a bit better about it.
I also like a democratically planned yet. It's like, so something can only be adaptive if it isn't democratically planned. That's an interesting admission that they've put forward there.
I would also say this is basically we are an almost permanent collapse watch.
Weep,
now.
Weep.
I mean, with an early life, we're in collapse watch.
We've got it all.
We've got it all.
Should look at the wee 5 points thing they've got here as well.
The 5 points is the big one. Whereabouts is that?
Just scroll up.
Ooh. Where?
It should be on. It's part of the same text.
Where?
I keep skipping past it. I need to be able to actually read the middle there.
Oh, sorry, there it is.
Yeah.
I thought it was a big list.
No. The letter offers five principles. Sorry, you guys. Keeps adjusting the text and you move the page. It's not worked in a long future. The letter offers five principles for the recovery of the economy, because they have this idea that there is green growth, that capitalism and the dynamics of the market was going to solve climate change, and have decided that actually that's not enough. More must be done.
No, we need more suffering.
So, one, put life at the center of our economic systems, whatever the hell that means.
Apart from the abortion claim.
Yeah, no, apart from that. Radically reevaluate how much and what work is necessary for a good life for all. So who's going to be doing the radical reevaluation there?
Yeah, who's going to reevaluate? Who's going to decide what a good life for all consists of? Who's going to decide whose work is no longer necessary?
Yep.
I am an essential worker. Again, this is timed precisely with the lockdowns, because this was the process people were being put through currently.
Yes. No, exactly.
And this is a way of saying you are suffering, but you are actually suffering for the planet.
Organize society around the provision of essential goods and services. Think universal basic income.
Yeah.
Who, Andre Gorz, is one of the main figures that came up with that idea in 1989, as we were reading earlier on.
Yes.
Minimum infrastructure guarantee, which is, of course, directly connected to the 15-minute cities, as I was posting on Twitter earlier on about. Then we've got point four, our favourite, democratise society.
Again, all of this is so good because it interfaces so well with a lot of the stuff we talk about. It's almost like we made this up to make us look right.
People are asking, can we get to doing a soundboard?
Maybe.
We'll think about it.
Maybe we could make our own little... No, we prefer to improvise.
No, it is good fun improvising. And five, base political and economic systems on the principle of solidarity.
Extreme,
which basically means making a united front with any force we need to in the meantime to get the work we want done now.
Yes.
Done. And then I think, if I remember correctly, either on the page at the bottom here, on the bottom of the next page, it's like, well, check the list of all the signatories. I can't... Is it?
Yeah.
It might be on the... Scroll up again, sorry.
Yeah.
If you click on the link for the letter.
Yeah.
And then scroll down on that page.
Yep. List of signatories. Yeah.
See all 2,000 signatories from 60 countries and 70 institutions. Oh.
Wah, wah. Doesn't exist.
Womp womp. Where did it go?
Well, basically the excuse here is the current economic downturn is not degrowth, even if some people misleadingly call it that. Degrowth means...
It's got to be collapsed the way we do it.
Degrowth means ensuring everybody's basic needs are met by transforming our societies. With policies in place so that we could shut down much of the economy for months and everyone would still have enough food, shelter and healthcare. In a degrowth society, we relocalized economies. With relocalized economies, a pandemic like COVID-19 would be less likely, would spread less and would cause less... So they're basically talking about actually like the climate slash...
This is like the mask off bits when we were talking about rewilding, where they're like, well, actually, yes, if you put fertility knowledge or knowledge about fertility onto the people, you reduce the population and replacement rate.
Yeah.
And they just had that stuff as part of their manifesto. And it's like, well, if you put that anywhere else in an article, people would call it a conspiracy theory. But
yeah, the becoming a minority stuff is predicated on replacement level immigration, which is kind of an amazing thing to just admit. But that's that. This is the degrowth website. Do we want to get to? We've already gone over the. Have we gone over the open democracy one?
No, we haven't yet.
We haven't yet. But I think the next one we really need to get to is the list of signatures doesn't work. This is a PDF from 2001.
That's there is more pages to that. My phone was not wanting to.
There's a lot more pages than that. Basically, it talks about degrowth here, but there's a quote.
It is an attempt to repoliticize debates about desired socio-environmental futures and an example of an activist-led science now consolidating into a concept in academic literature. This article discusses the definition, origins, evolutions, practices, and construction of degrowth. The main objective is to explain degrowth's multiple sources and strategies in order to improve its basic definition and avoid reductionist criticisms.
Well, let's scroll all the way down to that's the references here. The conclusion section here, which is just kind of funny.
That's the top of the page you're on, I think. I just like the fact they've got a la Al Gore there as part of a line on something.
Yeah. Keep going up. No, I just want to read this last bit here.
Cool.
But we can... let's have a look, quick look at where the conclusions start. Better definitions of degrowth, blah, 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 blah. But no, at the end of it here, it talks about... it kind of restates what we just read in longer form. Degrowth is an example of an activist-led science where an academic slogan is slowly consolidating into a concept that can be analysed and discussed in the academic area. The sources from which degrowth draws and the strategies and political proposals that degrowth puts forward are often not new, but the combination is innovative and, in our view, coherent. We have argued in favour of their compatibility and complementarity for two reasons. First, they do not... Basically, what they're talking about is like, look, this is just like standard like climate managerial policy clothed in Marxism.
Look at the second one there.
Yeah.
Second, the diversity maintains a sort of tension which stimulates constructive debates and exchanges, offering an incentive for continuous improvements both at the theoretical and practical levels, i.e. people who are actually at the helm of this operation can at any and all times tear down what has been produced, say it's racist, and make them start again.
Yeah, it's completely open to redefinition. Yeah. It's
therefore,
also,
the differences and conflicts within should be recognised and valued as forces that keep the movement open and alive in its continuous evolution.
Basically, it's made up by activists. It has nothing to do with science or theory. It is pure like policy in, you know, in quotes. Whole cloth. They are making this up and then reclothing it as some sort of scientific or economic debate in their own literature. So that's that's kind of where we are. But I'd like to get on to some more of the roots.
Here's Jason Heckel, one of the signatories mentioned on the degrowth page.
Yeah, this is from back in 2015. But this is more of a sentiment of the old version of degrowth and how it used to be justified.
Yeah, I noticed as well that they've titled this as part of their development 2030 column.
Yeah.
I doubt this article was put on that as when it was first put out. That's probably a later characterization, isn't it? Or categorization.
Yes, it is. It's working in develop 2030 was part of that 2015, like slightly abandoned now because people picked up on it even then, like Agenda 2030 stuff. But it's just entitled rather provocatively, forget developing poor countries, it's time to develop rich countries. As the UN's new Sustainable Development Goals are launched in New York, which is the Agenda 2030 stuff, there's little to celebrate about business-as-usual approach.
I like how as well on this, you've got an article on the side there about like £1 meals made of like chickpeas and seeds.
Yeah. lovely. Yes. Yeah.
This week, heads of state are gathering in New York to sign the UN's new sustainable SDGs. The main objective is to eradicate poverty by 2030. Beyoncé, One Direction, and Malala are on board. It's set to be a monumental international celebration. Given all the fanfare, one might think the SDGs are about to offer a fresh plan for how to save the world. But beneath all the hype is business as usual. The main strategy for eradicating poverty is the same. Growth.
Ooh.
Orthodox economists insist that all we need yet is more growth. More progressive types tell us that we need to shift some of the yields of growth from the richer segments of the population to the poorer ones. Evening things out a bit, neither approach is adequate. Why? Because even at current levels of average global consumption, we're overshooting our planet's biocapacity by more than 50% each year.
I've put in the notes as well that this really is like third world Malthusianism as a redressed up like political conversation. It is pure like socialist Malthus.
Yeah,
what they've done is they created this situation of, you know, the revolution of mass and scale, ever bigger societies, ever bigger populations, enforced mass immigration.
Well, it's...
and they bring out these things to arbitrate. They've created this problem. They've created the line go up, immigrants need to flood in to keep line going up, you know, situation as their own construction, and now they're bringing out this as a pre-made solution to their own lie.
I do like the little other article he's got there in the top left that's referenced. It will take 100 years for the world's poorest people to earn $1.25 a day, not at the rate they're printing them.
Yeah.
but there is also, not an admission here, but it helps you understand this as well if you recognise that, you know, the early Bolsheviks realized they had to sort of proletarianize the people to make them understand themselves as pros.
It very much is that.
So you've got to degrowth the people into climate consciousness. You've got to do it to them. Then they'll be okay with it.
Well, there's this weird, again, there's the gross national happiness myth thing where people talk about. But again, a lot of the roots of this are very like third worldist, literal communist resentment.
Like French communist people that hang around with like Nigerian and Algerian revolutionaries
like,
all day.
It's actually just like Colombians, Cubans, and Mexicans like sat in their own shit going, why don't we have things?
What do you mean half the people in the Vatican then?
Perhaps we might take a cue from Latin Americans, who are organizing alternative visions around the indigenous concept of buen vivir, or good living, or lots of beheading, as we see from most of South America. The West has its own tradition of reflection on the good life, and it's time we revive it. How much isn't, you know, talk about how much is enough, basic income, shorter working week, banning advertising, all of which...
reducing consumption.
Yeah.
Either we slow down voluntarily or climate change will do it for us. We can't go on ignoring the laws of nature. I don't know. Politics has revolved around doing that for a couple of centuries at this point. But rethinking our theory of progress is not only an ecological imperative, it is also a development one. If we do not act soon, all our hard-won gains against poverty will evaporate as food systems collapse and mass famine re-emerges to an extent not seen since the 19th century. But do they not understand that the total amount of things we produce nowadays are only possible because it is so widespread?
The main thing I wanted to get to, though, was this last paragraph, which is just an amazing, like, this person knows he's lying when you read this. This is not about giving anything up. And it's certainly not about living a life of voluntary misery or imposing harsh limits on human potential. That's what it's actually about. I mean, it's stated within the text that it's about that. On the contrary, it's about reaching a higher level of understanding and consciousness about what we're doing here and why.
Mm.
It's, you know, you don't actually want to live a better life materially. That's false consciousness.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's, I mean, you've got to proletarianize them. But I like the mention here as well. Jason Hickel is an anthropologist at the London School of Economics. So here we are, a century after...
LSE, yes.
Yeah, century after Charles Darwin's son goes to London School of Economics to make these sweeping eugenicist polemics about sterilising criminals and the poor. And here we are a century later with people coming up with solutions for the same problems.
Where's the... There's some really good bits towards the end of this as well.
This is the open democracy one.
Yes, it is. I think it's, if I search, there we go.
Oh, this is the bit where they do the switcheroo about saying it's top down, but it's actually grassroots, so it's not.
They basically talk, they waffle on a lot about democracy as they would do being open democracy. They waffle on about a lot of the stuff we've heard so far about living simpler lives, living better, saving the planet, you know, all being responsible humans. But then it gets to this point. And it says, despite the grassroots origins of degrowth, many proposals suggest the need for high level of state intervention. The majority of these proposals follow a top-down approach and have a national geographical focus. Many proposals require direct control by governments through measures such as caps, taxes, and regulations, suggesting the need for a high level of state intervention to pursue a degrowth transition. This contradicts the discourse of many degrowth proponents, which is usually focused on the need for a voluntary and democratic downshift, and thus an intrinsic pursuit of a more public space so the civil society can be an active agent of change. However, the categorization of proposals into top-down and bottom-up categories may be controversial. In fact, it is important to note that some proposals classified as top-down may have the goal of indirectly driving bottom-up action. An example is a proposal to reduce working hours. Although many people might prefer to work fewer hours, this can only happen if institutions are reformed to give them this choice.
Oh, you've got to reform it to give them this choice. The people themselves can't just turn around and only work 40 hours a week because they want to.
It's really funny that open democracy is turning around going, well, if we force people to do things and then they do them, they've chosen to do them. Therefore,
it's the same notion again. If you proletarianize them, then they understand themselves as pros. How great. You make them poor and worse off than they were before, and then they become agitated and work towards your political goals. As the ecological economist Georgios Kallas argues, it can be difficult for parties on the left to make degrowth their banner because of the difficulties of confronting an entrenched common sense. That said, it is at least expected of genuine progressive parties to have ideas in place on how to ensure society's prosperity and equality without undermining the ecological stability of our planet, i.e., this will be the continuing discourse for decades through which people will be just excoriated from the political system because they either aren't progressive enough or aren't climate change enough, and you've got to constantly sort of divvy up between the two.
Well, we'll talk about it a bit later, but again, I want you to keep in mind the myths that this is all predicated on.
Mm.
The very boomer truth regime that this is, you know, there's never worked. These ideas have never functioned. I've actually got a Mises article later
Do function.
Yeah.
They function to give these people power, which is the real goal.
Oh, no, but they've never functioned in the kind of naive reading, front-facing way, in that we move upwards towards, you know, full luxury space communism. That hasn't... hasn't worked, and they're having to point out the fact now that that hasn't worked and isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go into the real meat of it here, even though we're 40 minutes in. Good Lord, we need to hurry up. which is the fact that The Economist has a vertical called Impact, in which they essentially will tailor their content in an advertorial sense
I reckon
to NGOs
just,
and companies.
You just got to the bit of text you showed me out of this the other day, because that was so much of saying it the quiet part out loud, it was actually hilarious.
Here's The Economist saying the quiet part loud about their Impact vertical. Economist Impact combines the rigor of a think tank with the creativity of a media brand to engage an influential global audience. We partner with corporations, foundations, NGOs, and governments across big things including sustainability, health, and the changing shape of globalization to catalyze change and enable process. With the power of The Economist group behind it, Economist Impact crafts bespoke partnerships using a potent portfolio of capabilities including policy research and insights,
and of
branded
course,
content, media and advertising, design thinking and data visualization, global and bespoke events.
And of course, for our great love of the nation of Israel, it is only right for us to disclose that The Economist Group is, of course, 21% owned by the Rothschilds.
Yes.
But that's by the by. But the thing as well is that you mentioned to me that this, you can't just find this page.
No, this is
this is like an internal industry thing.
This is meant for inter-business purposes.
Does this not get worse as well as you
it
scroll
does,
down?
It does. It's our change equation. Insight plus innovation plus influence equals impact. What makes us different is the combination of policy research and insights, creative innovation, and our global influence. It's a formula that drives business value and creates change. It's basically them going, we will say whatever you want us to say.
Mm.
As long as it meets these agendas, as long as you're talking about, you know, globalization, sustainability, or health, we will say whatever your NGO puts us up to saying, and we will say it enthusiastically. It is The Economist nakedly whoring out their platform to NGOs, to governments.
As it, well, it's kind of funny because it's like as if we didn't know this already happened, but.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great admission, like, oh, this is exactly how it works. And this is exactly how we said it would
work. Well, they talk about, like, our work. Oh, we partnered with Google, the Nippon, you know, Deutsche Bank, MSC, it's a lot more than
NTI.
This as well. Yeah. New globalization, health, sustainability, new globalization. They are...
Global treasury thought leading, well, online influencing tools.
Well, they are very, very nakedly just going in shilling for people. I'm not going to play it here because we might get a copyright strike for it, but there's a very funny video that will be in the notes.
Deep Lore still running?
I believe so, yes.
No wonder we're getting murdered in the view count.
No, we're actually doing pretty well. but yeah, how do you make a lasting impact? Basically, it's just a corporate video of them going through and like showing Davos people that they're shaking hands with.
Is Tony Blair in this?
Yes, he is. Where is he?
There he is.
There he is. Now they basically go through and say, we know the global elite.
What's up with this woman in the bottom left here? She's worked out something's no right.
Yeah, she's got a bit of a look to her. But it'll be in the show notes.
Not the Dark Lord himself.
The links afterwards, but this video is hilarious because it's just basically them saying, we'll say whatever you tell us to say. But The Economist had a... again, it's their impact vertical. It's the sustainability project, which is sponsored by a company called SAP. We'll get onto them in a bit. but they have what is essentially a fake dialectic here. They are queuing up a debate between green growth
and
degrowth.
Yes. One is capitalist, the other is not.
Well, this is a guest op-ed from Susan Paulson, a professor at the Center for Latin American Studies. So she's not an economist. She's not a climatologist. She is basically a Latin American communist.
but excuse me, I think you find her life experience allows her to be an authority on the subject.
Again, this is getting into the weird South American, like, revenge
anti-colonialization
fantasy.
Anti-colonialization stuff.
again, this piece is part of a series, Reimagining Economics for a Carbon Constrained World.
And of course, if the carbon's constrained, you have to count it.
Yeah, it argues that economic growth measured in terms of GDP already contributes to environmental degradation and social harm and makes a case for the degrowth movement.
The views expressed in the blog are the author's own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Economist, Impact, or the sponsor.
Well, basically, they've got the fake rebuttal, which is, again, the
Rita's take.
Yeah, terrible. And then there's like a GDP thing which we got onto, but global scientists agree that wealthy countries must reduce material production and consumption in order for the world to successfully tackle climate change, biodiversity collapse, ocean acidification, water scarcity, and other environmental problems. So that's where we're starting from. We're starting from, you will suffer.
Yeah. Research in the field of degrowth examines empirical relations between economic growth, defined as increased monetary value of goods and services exchanged in a market. So, it's not a value measure. It's an inflationary measure, often calculated as GDP. And material growth, defined as increased biophysical throughput, energy, material, and waste flows of an economy, measured as social metabolism. Oh, Britain consumes a billion calories every day. Is that the sort of crap they're going
this,
for here?
This is like woohoo stuff. Yeah. Degrowth science connects economics with thermodynamics to demonstrate how the transformation of material and energy into goods and services converts generally reliable and consistent low-entropy stocks of resources into disordered and chaotic high-entropy waste.
This is called complexity.
This is like pure, like, mixing the disciplines horseshit.
People who don't understand the division of labour be like...
Well, this is just like pure baffledom with science
stuff. What's the next paragraph here? This just gets hilarious.
Yeah.
These data refute certain statements attributed to economist Diane Coyle in the introductory article of this debate series starting in the 1990s. GDP growth became light as a feather, made of bits rather than atoms, and literally not weighed anything. All the incremental value added growth was intangibles. Oh my god. Ah, this is too many like technocrats talking to one another here.
Basically what they're saying is though that the GDP, the actual manufacturing output of Western nations, has stagnated since the 1970s, which is true.
Yes.
Heavy industry has grown or receded in the West.
It's almost like we've replaced all industry with secondary and tertiary industry garbage that are all make-work schemes or something.
The trick here is that the degrowth movement is analysing and admitting what we all know is true,
yes,
that GDP is bullshit. And has been bullshit, yeah, since its inception.
Questions about prioritizing GDP growth also address its correlation over the past four decades with unconscionable increases in inequality among and within countries, and its failure to correlate with vital indicators of well-being above very low thresholds. I mean, this is them trying to come up with some, like, the Uber stat.
Yeah.
The stat that tells them everything they need to know.
Foremost among these principles are democracy, diversity, participation, abundance, in contrast to the prevailing notions of hierarchy, competition, and scarcity that underpin currents. Well, those are the things that underpin reality. The whole premise of the degrowth movement is that we already live in a post-scarcity society, which we do not.
Yes.
And
that's the only way they could get to the opinion of, well, if we just have all the resources we have now and reorganize them to other people, then we can keep that sort of floating, as it were.
We are not here to debunk degrowth.
No.
It doesn't work on the face of it. You do not live in a post-scarcity society. Therefore, deindustrializing and degrowing your countries will make people suffer and die.
As we've witnessed since at least the 70s, if not.
But these ideas are not genuine, as we've seen. They come, yes, from a place of, like, post-Marxist managerial socialism.
Or, shall we get to the other end of that equation?
Which is power.
Yes. They well, not so much power. I mean, the groups that are backing this stuff.
Oh yeah. Well,
one sap, as it were.
Yeah. We'll get onto that after we kind of go through just what utter horseshit this is. Resource drain from the global south.
Buen Vivir again.
Yes, it is. It's them talking about their weird third worldist, you know, southern hemisphere takes revenge on the northern hemisphere fantasy, which is still a large part of degrowth. Again, the conclusions here are quite funny. Talks about CO2 emissions domestically, tries to increase resource efficiency, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Moreover, national accounting system often displaced these costs. For example, the use of biofuels has helped some countries to reduce CO2 emissions domestically while creating carbon debt elsewhere.
As production of biofuel stock replaces rainforests and savannas and Amazon. Well, yeah, that again, it's an admission that what they're doing doesn't work.
Mm.
You can't transfer the quality of life, in quotes, in the material sense we have currently, to the green future.
Mm.
It doesn't, the sums don't work, GDP doesn't function, none of this stuff functions, it's unworkable by design, which is, again, we'll have a whole stream about the fact that it's unworkable by design, but they are identifying the problems in their own bullshit and then using them to justify what is essentially a global Malthusian, you know, nominally, you know, ideologically communist system, but it is not really. I don't want to sit here and go, this is literally communism, because it isn't.
Because, well, also, that's a waste of time, and everyone knows that.
It's not, I would impress on people that this is not communism. Look at, we talked about him before, look at Gauze.
I just like one of the comments that, wow, these sure are some words.
Yeah, well, that's what it is. It's word salad to justify an idea that does not work, and cannot work, and will not work. But all of this is sponsored by SAP. Well, who are SAP? Who we saw it earlier. Who has gone to the Economist and basically said, we want this, exactly like this. Make us some propaganda bespoke. Well, SAP is the world's third largest publicly traded software company. It is the fourth largest software company in the world. It is the largest non-American software company by revenue. It is the largest software, but therefore is the largest
founded
software
company. Founded in 1972 as well.
Yeah, therefore the largest software company in Europe. It is possibly the largest business software company.
Someone's asking the obvious question, owned by whom?
I'm afraid it's a bunch of Germans. Whether it's Germans in quote... I have a look. Basically, it's IBM and former, I believe, Xerox divisions in Germany merged. Further,
it seems to have a formation. Yeah. Xerox exited the computer hardware manufacturing industry and they one asked IBM to migrate its business systems. Is that basically just like a German branch of IBM and Xerox that went off to become its own thing? But as it says in the right there, you know, it's a company with €30 billion revenue.
Well, it's interesting what they do as well.
100,000 employees.
100,000 employees, €72 billion in total assets. Like I said, they are the largest non-American software company in the world.
Wait. Say it ain't so. Are these people putting themselves forward as the people that would manage the systems that would monitor degrowth?
Well, they are a kind of a management software. They purely do like enterprise planning.
Enterprise resource planning.
Yeah.
These
aren't bean counters. These are advanced bean counters. Now, they create a lot of management software, supply chain software. They're the biggest company in the world for that. Mm. And that's who's sponsoring some weird Latin American studies communist to talk about, you know, the thermodynamics of the economy in complete word salad. He is their sustainability vertical. Zero emissions, zero waste, zero inequality.
So we'd all have to be dead then?
Yes.
Because we can't have dead people and living people. Awards and inequality.
These people...
holistic steering and ESG reporting, climate action... They've got a thing up there about the circular economy.
Well, these are the people selling ESG software.
Well, no, but the thing up there, circular economy as well, that would be a sort of long-winded model whereby they're discussing essentially degrowth systems.
Well, we'll get into that as well. We do have that in our little document here. But, it's just,
it's just so funny that all this stuff is going on at the behest of the largest non-American software company in the world, the largest kind of inter-business software company in the world. It's a company you've probably never heard of, but like I said, it's massive. Imagine this was IBM. Mm. They are basically a company the size of IBM in terms of revenue, assets, and employees. In fact, at this point, they may be even bigger. So that's kind of where it's coming from. There's also here, which is supposedly the rebuttal here. Or at least I think this is part of the framing. Sorry. There's a third one here, which is part of the framing, which is him basically talking about the fact that the GDP model is broken. It's like economic growth at all costs. What is the trade-off? It's them, we've talked about it before, breathlessly admitting that, you know, well, economic growth is driving greenhouse gas emissions and, you know, here's all the pollution, here's China's pollution, and it's going to be part, again, of the weird, like, eco-war on China we're all going to supposed to wage.
Yeah, an unrealistic paradigm. Is this, again, the Miss Coyle thing they were talking about before? Miss Coyle points out that the increasingly weightless nature of GDP in rich countries means that a dollar of growth leads to far fewer carbon emissions than it used to, because the dollar buys you less than it used to.
And also, none of that, like, it's not real. They're just making stuff up. It's fake jobs paid with fake money.
The system of environmental economic accounting framework, they've got the next paragraph in.
Good Lord.
Adopted by the United Nations Statistical Commission at the first international standard for environmental economic accounting, is another tool that aims to quantify the contribution of the environment to the economy and the impact of the economy on the environment. I would imagine that SAP had absolutely nothing to do with the development of that system.
Well, basically what he's talking about here is, well, we'll move away from GDP, we'll just go to a different macro measure.
They need their magic Uber stat.
Yeah, they're both talking about the magic Uber stat. They're talking about...
But one wants a communist one and one wants a capitalist one.
Yeah, it's basically a debate of whether or not you will have a red pod or you will have a blue pod.
Mm.
Both of these essays lead to the same conclusion, which is we're moving away from GDP, we've got to do it because the planet's dying, and we will do it through a moderated system, either be it with a social equity focus or a technological management focus.
Or both.
And what they are settling on here really is both. I put in a little bit of a Mises article here for 2017, talking about how GDP is a tool of politics and economics, which it is. I'm not going to read this in detail. It's just a good source if you want to kind of clue yourself up on some of the problems of GDP.
Why an aggregate statistic like GDP actually tells you nothing useful about an economy?
Well, this is the rebuttal as well. This is smart growth can help achieve a good life for all without killing the planet.
Is this the Michael Jacob one they mentioned previously?
Yeah, this is the Michael Jacob one. And again, he comes out and talks about, here's the same graph. It's all the same stuff.
Growth is the goal. There is a widely held belief that economists regard economic growth as the most important goal for policymakers to pursue. However, most economists are well aware that economic growth should not be a policy goal per se, because a good life cannot be reduced to mere material consumption.
But that's what they've... Again, the arbitration here, and what I want to talk about, is this arbitration. It is them letting go of the myth of line go up.
Mm.
You've been told throughout your entire life by these very people, line go up. You give us control, line will go, you will be safe. You will not be free, but you will be rich and you will be safe.
Again, it is well understood GDP fails to capture the extent to which an economy achieves societal goals. It feels so belaboured.
Again, it's the false dialectic between smart growth and revenge on the colonizer.
Yes.
We just keep seeing it over and over and over here. Human Development Index, things like that, which is even worse. Have you ever seen the HDI? Oh, America.
HDI.
America's 50th on the HDI. We need to be more like Sweden and have hand grenade attacks in our primary schools. Absolute, like, this is the empiricoids we're dealing with. It's, well, you know, Human Development Index,
overly materialistic dietary shifts, healthier lifestyles,
higher, greener GDP.
It's basically talking about the fact that ESG measuring should link what is GDP to greenhouse gas emissions. Yeah.
For example,
stuff.
A price on GHG emissions that accounts for the harmful effects of fossil fuels would reduce their use and at the same time boost demand for clean alternatives. If you make one thing more expensive than the other, people use the cheaper option. Well done. With higher monetary values attributed to goods such as renewable energy sources and lower monetary values for bads such as GHG emissions, efforts to decarbonize the economy would in turn result in a higher GDP. Yeah, because you'd price fix the entire thing. I mean, again, this is a similar conversation to some of the stuff we looked at in like the kind of green imperialism discussions.
Yeah.
And that, oh, well, we've got to de-invest or divest from greenhouse gas producing industries in the third world, which means starving the third world.
Yeah. It's what it means. Oh, well, we can't do that. So what we'll do is we'll take all our resources, we'll go back to living in mud huts, and we'll redistribute it evenly over the Earth's surface.
Yeah. We'll ban LPG gas amongst the people who don't know how to start fires.
Here, once again, we see the arbitration come in. For this reason, the question of whether infinite economic growth is possible in a world of finite natural resources might be restated as whether continued improvements in human well-being are possible without overstepping natural limits. The answer is likely yes, but only with the right policies in place. Designing these policies will require deep deliberation about what constitutes a good life for all. The threat here is that you will accept our arbitration via the management software of our sponsor, or we will feed you to the third world.
Yep.
That is the dialectic at play with degrowth, and that I think that exposes the non-genuine nature of it. It is purely a tool of power. But I want to get on to quickly...
This is the circular economy
stuff. This stuff links in with other buzzwords we'll have heard
before.
Well,
there was also an entire vertical section on the SAP website.
Yes, it was. Oh, and thank you to the halfling. I know who that is. Welcome.
That person followed me the other day, but I have no idea who it is.
I don't know. We know them.
Oh, you can tell me later.
I'll tell you, I don't know if they want their new stuff linked to their old stuff. I've not actually asked them that yet.
Ah, okay.
So do let me know if you're listening. I don't want to
dox them.
Yeah. No, I don't necessarily know if people know who that is or not, but. It's probably not an issue, but I don't want to make that call without asking. But thank you for becoming a Venus Pro. It's British Knight.
Ah, right, there we go.
So thank you for becoming.
He's become a Tolkien person these days. Then
I think I do enjoy the Shire. So
Shire appreciators.
Well, this is called circular economy or degrowth. It's basically them talking about. Well, both. But it's kind of talking about, again, some of the false dichotomy stuff here. It's now been widely acknowledged that a transition towards a circular economy is vital to tackle the climate emergency. Again, predicated on a settled science-solved debate.
This thought has become so mainstream.
that the Scottish government has even appointed its first circular economy minister. A position first held by the Scottish Greens' Lorna Slater. Ugh. It basically talks about the circular economy basically meaning it's the idea that you can recycle everything, which you can't.
No, I know. However, if you look through their website, you'll see that one of their top examples of the circular economy is the Renault car plant, which remanufactures certain vehicle components. This is obviously better than car plants that use new raw materials each time. But do we want a car manufacturing plant to be put in our pin-up pioneer of the circular economy? The optics of a car manufacturing place, even if it is like recycling, isn't good enough. In other words, we need to be careful that we don't let our genuine motivations for transitioning towards a circular economy and a just transition become another opportunity for greenwashing and corporate takeover. capitalism is a tricksy changeling and will take almost any form we ask it to take.
It basically, it's just like, no, we're actually just like destroying the market. We actually just don't care. That we're not, we're abandoning the pretense.
That's why I favour the term degrowth instead of working within our current economic system. Degrowth believes that to tackle the climate crisis, we need to shift towards a radically different model of economic growth. In other words, degrowth is a system which prioritises social and ecological well-being over corporate profit. Again, the exact same line that was in the bit earlier on. Also, this is Clackworks. Is this a bloody Clack Manager thing or something?
I'm not sure what it is. I just felt it's basically they're a...
Clackworks, oh, it's bloody Inverness. Fair enough.
Socially inclusive space for making. It's basically one of those like weird communist maker environments that doesn't actually do anything and no one's ever there.
It's because it's for people in Inverness, and anyone's a communist in Inverness has probably already killed themselves.
Well, that's actually a pretty good summary of the link between the circular economy and degrowth, in that one is kind of a gentler version of the other. Winning the battle against waste is a global imperative and a regenerative opportunity. Again, another article sponsored by, you know, SAP. Again, I'll impress certain people. This is all being said by the largest software company in Europe. The fourth largest software company in the world. Hundreds of billions of dollars in assets. And this is who's saying this. Based in Venice, disrespect. I'm not going to read this in full because it's more kind of a...
Well, let me guess. It's exactly the same article.
It's exactly
GDP doesn't do the job. Yeah. We need this. We need that. The efforts also improve the corporate bottom line. For a start, reducing waste. And that's just nonsense about recycling, isn't it?
It doesn't work. Everyone knows it doesn't work. It takes more energy than doing stuff with more raw materials, and the product is always worse. Here it is. Pakistan leads charge for climate justice at COP27. That's the one we talked about earlier, about they basically made up a bunch of bullshit stats and couldn't be called out.
They said all the floods that were happening in Pakistan were the fault of Britain.
Yes. But the reason I've kind of charged through a few of these, and the reason I wanted to get to this point of explaining all this to you guys, is there's a bit of a discussion to be had here about, one, we already talked about the arbitration about GDP, but there's a link here between degrowth and population increase by immigration in Western nations. And it's posited as a solution to the artificially inflated, non-skilled populations now present in the West. Again, it's a canned solution to the man-made Malthusian collapse future they all posit, even though, if you look at it, we'd have had a stable population since the 80s if they hadn't opened the floodgates to migrants. Global equity is a watchword for global managerialism. What degrowth would do in practice is attempt to create uniform economic conditions globally to make the administration more simple.
Whilst also providing a never-ending excuse for more measures, more reform, a more radical view.
Yes, it would accelerate demobilization and create static pockets of population whose movements are centrally controlled.
And monitored through things like low traffic networks, monitored through passports, which are soon to be digital, monitored through purchases, which are all digital near enough now.
These more, homogenized economic conditions are also linked to the attempts to create more uniform demographics. The idea is that you will be an interchangeable economic unit of roughly the same worth as everyone else on the earth. And it will make the management process of millions of people easier. That's what it is. It's about making managing you easier. That's the main driver here. It will break the backs of many Western populations who still have some kind of residual bourgeois power, very Leviathan and its enemies.
Basically, the middle class are going to cop it unbelievably.
Yes, and reduce them to South American-style semi-subsistence living.
See, the thing is as well, is they actually won't have to implement any degrowth policy. They'll just let the interest rate continue to tick up, and this all happen naturally.
I'm going to say, everyone is already so leveraged that this has essentially already happened. If the British government were to remove the debt teat and call in the debts of people, this would, like, Britain would collapse overnight if everyone had to pay their bills. Managing arbitrate resources more closely on a global scale, and it would destroy the last vestige of private industry and small business.
I don't want to go over that yet. That's when the license go over. But the practical upshot of this, really, and we're already seeing it, are things like this. It's things like the current food crisis we're having, which is artificially manufactured. Basically, you found this out. I didn't. I suspected I didn't know. A lot of the subsidies for like energy price increase haven't gone to farming and food storage.
No, despite the fact that growing, as you might imagine, certain fruit and vegetables out of season in Britain is a very energy intensive process.
Yeah.
You know, not only do you need a large, you know, output of lumens and BTUs, you also need lights that are operating at a very specific wavelength and frequency. You need all these controllers to run it.
Yeah.
So it takes up an unbelievable amount of energy. And there was still some to extent where this was being done profitably as an alternative to the usual seasonal farming in Britain. However, it got to at some point last year, and a lot of these companies that do indoor farming put their hands up and went, look, we're spending an absolute fortune for electricity here. We can't afford to, you know, make peppers and mushrooms and fruit and vegetable out of season.
Yes.
So can we have money, please? And the government turned around and said no, for one reason or another. And now because of that, they've had to jack the prices up ridiculously, which now means you've got Tesco and Aldi and Asda saying, well, it's the farmers that are trying to screw us because they want to charge 30 pence more for a bag of peppers than they were charging last year. And it's like, well, no wonder, because it's costing them 35 pence more in electricity to produce it.
This is what happens when you degrow your economy. You just stop being able to grow food. This is what decarbonization looks like. A lot of these apple trees will be hundreds of years old. This is an incredible tragedy that's happening in the south of England. And the fact that a part of it is because they have to pay if they're growing crops. Like, they can't just leave the apple trees in situ. They'd be destitute if they did that.
And also, at the same time, I mean, I might not be quite perfect on the numbers here, but I think you could optimistically suggest that on average in Britain, a hectare of land produces about £350 per crop. And that's a good going at the moment. The British government wants to offer farmers at the moment nearly £600 a hectare to grow a legume crop for 2 years.
A fallow crop, yes.
Which you can't even crop at the end. So they want you to grow birdseed in land that should be used to grow food that we can't afford, but instead they're paying them double what they normally get for making food to just put the fields out to fallow, essentially.
Yeah, quite literally, the English Shire is being scoured.
Mm-hmm.
It is the scouring of the Shire, and it is an incredible tragedy. But this is the upshot of the decarbonisation of these new economic policies. This is what it looks like in reality. All of them, the net zero stuff, the degrowth stuff, is all the same front but the same method, which is we can't manage this mess anymore. We're just going to pretend that we're being virtuous by letting you all gradually fall back down to material squalor. You have been, you know, spiritually degraded post-war. Well, you have had, you know, your community removed from you. You've had your church removed from you. You've had, you know, your sense of a people removed from you. And now all of those material gains that were supposed to justify that are being reduced back. You are being reduced back down to subsistence, but without any of the things that people in Britain had when they were subsistence farmers.
All that's ringing through my head is the bloody lyrics to the Dead Kennedys' Cambodia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You work harder with a gun in your back for a bowl of rice a day. Slave for soldiers till you starve, then your head is skewered on a stake.
It's, where's he gone? Oh no, I selected everything by accident.
But.
Yes, welcome. Well, I guess it's not welcome to the apple fields, because the apple fields have been dug up.
Yeah, but it is funny though, because I remember you picked up on the chat that I had, like, sort of, you know, 3 years ago now at the start of COVID, which was, don't worry, we'll all be cycling between our dirt farms if we'll be lucky. And here we are.
Here we are, cycling between the dirt farms. Let me find it here. Sorry, I've not got a certain link up that I want to finish on. So I'll just put, before we finish, I'll put Andre Gorz's thing back up here.
Have you not got it in the bottom of the notes?
No, I do not. I've got a quote here, but I want to put something on stream, so I'll quickly get that up. Andre Gorse, who we talked about right in the beginning, is the person who came up with the term degrowth. And he wrote in the 1980s a book called Farewell to the Working Class. It's also translated as Farewell to the Proletariat.
Oh, 50% off black authors for Black History Month. Oh. That's good that we've celebrated them by cutting their profits.
But yeah, Andre Gorse, he's the third worldish, you know, he's the person who wants this radical degrowth. But his argument by 1980 was that the working class and the industrial class didn't matter. That they didn't matter to the causes of Marxism and socialism because
they've not been proletarianized enough.
Yeah, because they've been superseded. I'll read this verbatim here. Andrew Gorse argues that changes in the role of work and labor process in the closing decades of the 20th century have, once and for all, weakened the power of skilled industrial workers. Their place has been taken, says Gorse, by social movements such as the women's movement and the green movement, and all those who refuse to accept the work ethic so fundamental to early capitalist societies. As unemployment rises, the struggle, Gorse insists, is not the right to work, but for an income regardless of work, to the sharing of the reduced amount of necessary social labour, above all, the primacy of autonomous, self-determined activity.
And therein is the sort of crux as to why third worldists, Marxists, acolytes of the Frankfurt School, and the fourth largest software company in the world with a, you know, managed assets of 70 billion euros would all be discussing the same concept.
Yes. Why is the fourth largest software firm in the world, the largest in Europe, discussing a third worldist Marxist and Frankfurt School inspired idea? Like, why is the degrowth narrative coming from a $100 billion company?
Welcome to the legume fields.
Welcome to the legume fields, motherfucker. But a lot of people be very confused by this. And green capitalism, greenwashing. It's not. It's that these people get to arbitrate the suffering. We keep telling you that the suffering is the point. And a lot of people seem confused by that. The point of suffering is to arbitrate it. Mm. You come in and you create a problem, and then you become its solution. It is a tale as old as time, you know, with the expansion of government, with the expansion of power. Making you suffer.
The ideology doesn't matter. It's about power, and it always is.
That is how you end up with SAP, a software conglomerate, putting forward essentially 1970s raw Frankfurt School ideology. It's because it benefits them.
Yep. I don't think we can really add much more to that.
No, not really. I think it's you. We'll be looking at like deindustrialization, deglobalization at some point. Probably not next week. We're scattering some of these green streams around as an exhaust people. But it all leads back to the same place, which is the ideology within them is not genuine, and you should not engage with it on its own terms.
Don't engage with it as if it's a rational political formula, because it's not. As I wrote in the Substack post on Thursday, if you genuinely believe in forms of political legitimacy, then I have to introduce you to the ancient democratic institution of gang rape.
Well, that leads us on to, I guess, our end shilling here. If you guys have not been over to the Substack, do go over and check out the Substack. We do put stuff out twice a week at the moment. I've seen we got a couple of donations. I will read those before the end. Don't worry, guys. Do interact with the video, you know, like, subscribe, all that cringy YouTube-y stuff, because it does actually help us. Otherwise, you won't see our videos.
Yes, please do.
Thank you to everyone who donated. We will be streaming on Wednesday as well. We'll be doing the Hope Not Hate State of Hate 2023, which we are tangentially in this year, but it mostly feels like we're in because they're running out of steam.
Yes.
Which is a bit of a backhanded thing to us. Couple more donations here. Thank you to Melon for the $2. You guys punch way above your weight. Good job. Thank you for the encouragement. Coney, current year. I used to think degrowth was Greta T. Eco-Marxism.
And Maoism.
Yeah, but basically, it's all, as you've read, the actual theory supposedly behind it is complete waffle.
Mm.
It's completely incomprehensible by design.
Well, yeah, it smacks me of the same kind of thing as Rewilding, which had a, you know, especially when you think about the institutions that write about it, like The Guardian.
Yeah.
You know, the anti-capitalist, anti-bourgeois, you know, anti-this, anti-privilege, anti-institution. And yet, here's these really softly worded articles about civil rights lawyers who get paid exorbitant amounts of money buying up land in some sort of government scheme that only they can access because they've got a fantastic credit score.
Yes.
Here it is again on a global scale. Marxist intellectuals offering and positing ideas that only multi-billion euro software companies could even think about facilitating.
Again, it is a further revolution of mass and scale to global wealth arbitration. So it's what you referred to as well as, what is it, global Zimbabweification.
Yes.
In that this is land and wealth reform on a truly global scale.
You've got Zimbabweification.
Zimbabweification. You've got to say it properly. We here are advocates of Rhodesiafication, but that's a different stream for a different time.
I think that's enough from us this evening.
Yeah, keep your shorts on. Stay in the bush.